Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about context switches and how they worked in XV6. Mentioned that there was another part where we needed to change the user space part, the current address space, and so on, that we'll get to much more later. We mentioned about POSIX, that there's this Unix-like OS, which XV6 is kind of in that vein, and that there were a lot of them, and they all came together to agree on some things about what the programmer interface is, and that's what we'll be talking about when we're talking about APIs and starting out for process management. We talked about fork, so that was POSIX choice for creating a new process. When you create a new process, it's a copy of the current one, so we just copy the process control block, the structure where we store all the information about our process, and we change the return value of fork depending on whether we're in the original or the copy. And the copy we called the child, the original we called the parent. Now, if we want to run a different program, that's a separate call, which we had execv was the example I gave. There's a bunch of functions which start with exec. What they all do is take our current program, replace it with some other program loaded from disk. So we use the same process control block, but we create a new version of memory with the other program's memory and a new set of registers with the program's starting registers to start a new program at main in the same process control block with the same process ID. And it turns out the same open files that we started with before and so on. Now, if we're replacing our child process with another process, we need a way to know when that finishes. Like if we want to run ls, we probably don't want to just run ls. We want to know when it's done so we can do something else. And the function that POSIX provides for this is waitPID. So waitPID, we supply a process ID, and with that, we can say, I would like to wait for this to finish, and when it finishes, we learn about its exit status. So what it passed to exit, or we learn that, for example, maybe it's segfaulted. That's information that will be provided to us via waitPID. I also mentioned that waitPID has some options. So one of the options is that you can say, I don't want to wait for this to finish. Just tell me if it's done, and if so, give me its information. So there was an option we could pass as its third argument in order to say, just, I want to check, but I don't want to actually wait right now. Okay, so any questions about any of those? Yes? The question is, for the homework, do you have unlimited submissions? Yes, you can keep submitting. I will assume the last submission is the one you want me to grade, even if your last submission is late and you have an earlier not late submission. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's finish up talking about waitPID. So I mentioned that one special thing we can do with waitPID is ask, I did not edit this slide. Okay, it returns zero if this doesn't work. This is in the manual page. Returns zero if you wait for something and it isn't actually done. And another thing we can do is we can ask to wait for any child process. So if we forked a bunch of times, we can just say, give me the first thing that finishes, and that's an option for waitPID. So we had our example here where we looked at the exit status. You can also just wait for everything by passing -1, and the return value is 0 if we didn't have anything to wait for and it was normal, -1 if we had an error, like calling wait when you don't have any child processes is an error, and otherwise the PID that actually finished. And I mentioned last time that the exit status, you would think it's just the value passed to exit or return from main. It's not. It encodes other information. The most notable information it encodes is this notion of signaled. So Unix has something called signals, which you can send to processes. We're not going to talk about them very much, but Control C sends a signal. So Control C stopping a process stops it with a signal. Segfaults send a signal, and wait will tell you which signal caused a process to terminate if one did. So Control C is one. The kill command, which you may have used to stop a process, by default sends the term signal. Segfault is one, and there's a bunch of others. And that's information that wait PID returns. And in that case, there's no exit status to give you, obviously, so you shouldn't try to ask for the exit status because the program didn't exit or return from main. Okay, so any questions on wait PID? Yeah?
I guess this is on more of the exit status. What's the actual return type type of the exit status?
The question is, what's the type of the exit status? It is some sort of integer. I think it's limited to 1 byte, but I'm not actually sure if that's guaranteed. Other questions? And I mentioned no hang, so you can do this thing where you can check, is the child process done, or is there an error, or handle it exiting, so you can just check, and that's going to be important on our shell assignment, being able to do that. So I mentioned about parent and child processes as the names for things after we fork. The rule for wait is you can only wait for your child processes. You can pass whatever PIDs you want, but you'll get an error if you're not the parent. And every process, but process ID 1, has a parent process. And this means that there's a tree of processes which start with process ID 1. In fact, you can get this tree output with the pstree command on Linux, which will show you this representation of all processes. So you can see here I have small font, I have init, which is the parent of modem manager, network manager, accounts daemon, which have these child processes, which form this big tree. So you might say, every process has a parent process. Well, aren't there some cases where that kind of messes up? For example, what if the parent exits before the child does? Like, we can write some code which forks and then exits in the parent and doesn't in the child. What happens? The rule is that the child's parent process becomes process ID 1. And one of the jobs of process ID 1 on most systems is to wait for random things which have become reparented to process ID 1. So there's other issues that come up. So what if I don't wait for my child processes? What happens? And this is our zombie state we saw earlier. When I mentioned our process states, there's this funny one called zombie in XV6. And this is a child process that has terminated, but we haven't waited for yet. If we do that, it doesn't just go away. It's still there until we wait for it. At least enough of it is there that we can call wait and get its status. So it stays around as a zombie, and this at least reserves the PID, so it's not reused for something else until we're done retrieving the exit status. Okay, so any questions about these cases, or wait in general? Yes?
What's to keep a malicious program from having lots of zombies to the point where you can't have any more PIDs?
The question is, what keeps a program from just using all the PIDs? So the same thing which keeps it from using all the memory, that if you care about this, you'll set some limits per user or something like that on the number of PIDs you can use, just like you'll set limits on the amount of memory you could use, or the amount of CPU time you could use. So other questions? Yeah?
So if you have a zombie and then you call wait PID or wait on it, then after that, is it actually taken off?
The question is, if we have a zombie process and we call wait PID on it, is it taken off then? Yes. So zombies are just things that you can wait for because you haven't yet. that have actually finished. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so now that we have fork, exec, and wait, this gives our typical pattern for running programs, that we're going to fork in the child, we're going to exec a program, and have some code after the exec in case the exec fails, like the executable we're trying to run doesn't exist or we ran out of memory, so at least do something about that, like print an error. And when exec works, that's going to run the main of a new program. In the parent, we're just going to wait for the child to finish. And this is a pattern you'll see all over the place and on your first assignment. Now, sometimes you might want to run multiple programs, and you can absolutely do that because there's no requirement that you wait right away. Because remember that we keep around these zombies to remember things, even if you exec the child and it terminates right away, it doesn't matter that you're not waiting. The OS is going to keep that information around for you until you're ready to use it. So if you want to spawn multiple children, you can just fork them all, remember all their PIDs, and then later on actually wait for each of them. And that works fine. Or you could do something where you wait for them not in the order they appear in your vector. Same idea. But this is designed, but the system is designed to let you just spawn a bunch of child processes and figure it out later. You don't need to be ready to wait for it right away. Yes?
In the first if statement there, would you want to also break out of the loop? Because it seems like otherwise then the children would start spawning.
So the question is, do I need some code here to keep this from having the child also fork? And the answer is yes, but note that that code's only going to run in a case where exec fails. So my error handling code for exec should exit the loop. In fact, it probably should exit the process. But and I do should have that, or else I will keep trying to make more and more processes if exec doesn't work. If exec works, then there's no problem because we're not going to execute any code after this exec. Because that we're just going to be switching to main and never go main of the new program and never go back. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's most of our process control. So there's two other things I'm not going to talk about in much detail. One is exit, which you've seen before. I think you pass an exit status to it. That can be retrieved by wait. It causes the current program to terminate. If you return from main, there's some code which calls main, which calls exit with its main's return value. And we've seen on XV6, this comes up notably, that XV6 doesn't have that code, so we actually need to call exit ourselves at the end of main. And XV6's exit doesn't take in status because they wanted to make things a little simpler. There's also a kill. So if you know about the kill command, which terminates a process, that sends a signal to a process. And notably, this is the easiest way of, given a process ID, cause it to terminate. Okay, so I'm going to talk about shells. So the shell is a program which allows a user to run applications. So this is the user wrapper around process management functions. And the upcoming homework is to make a simple shell. You use the shell because you've used SSH, I assume, at some point, or the Linux command line at some point in some prior class. So you used a shell. The term shell is more expensive than just the sort of command line. Like, people would generally consider like the OS X Finder or Windows Explorer a shell because it lets you run programs, it lets you browse the file system. Those are the sorts of core things any shell lets you do. They're just graphical shells. You're going to make a simple command line, you know, of the sort you've probably used it for. And in fact, POSIX, in addition to specifying all these functions for creating processes, specifies a shell. We're not going to make a full POSIX shell because that's way too much work. But that's one form of command line specified. Now, let's talk about some features that POSIX command lines have that aren't so obvious, some of which aren't so obvious how to do with Merlin. So one thing that POSIX command lines have, which is not in our assignment, is they search for programs. That you type ls minus l, ls isn't in the directory you're in, but it figures out that, oh, ls is actually the program slash bin ls, or you type make, and it figures, oh, that's actually user bin make, and it figures this out, so it searches for programs, typically does this using the environment variable path to figure out where the programs might be, and it looks in each of those directories until it finds the program when you type it on the command line. So rather than having to memorize where all the programs are and type that all the time, you just type make, and it figures out, oh, make's in this directory, that's what I'm going to run. So another thing that shells support is running things in the background. So who's used ampersand on a shell? I guess the probably most common use that comes up is that if you have a graphical login to Linux machine and you want to run Emacs or some other graphical text editor in and still use the shell, this is how you do it. It runs it in the background. And what this means, functionally speaking, is that we're going to run the fork off the program and not wait for it immediately, at least not wait for it in a way which is going to cause us to not give you another prompt. So it's basically kind of doing less work, except we want to wait for it eventually or else we'll run out of processes because we'll have all these zombie process IDs reserved. So we still want to wait for it, but not in a way which causes us to stall and not accept more commands. So another feature that shells support, which you may have used, is redirection. That I can specify that a program's output goes to a text file instead of the terminal, and a program's input comes from a text file. And we'll talk about how that works a bit later. And similarly, I can specify that a program's output, instead of going to a text file, goes to the input of another program. So I can pipe up two programs. So I can have some program take its output, put it through some of another program called some filter, and whatever that program outputs is what I see. And that's a very common thing people will use on sort of POSIX-like systems, even if you haven't used it. And all these three features here are going to be in the next assignment. The way the assignment works is that there's a checkpoint, which is due after the first week, where you need to implement only these. And pipelines are the last week, which is a guess on what people found hard last time. So last time we did the assignment, we only gave 1 week, which was a mistake. but we didn't have doing things in the background as part of the assignment. But works. And I would note that for the checkpoint submission, the late policy gives minus 10% for 3 days late, but no credit after that, just for the checkpoint submission. And my plan is that assignments with checkpoints will be worth more than ones without, because we're expecting you to spend more time. And that usually I'll do something like make the checkpoint be like 10 to 30% of the assignment grade. And the final submission is going to be almost most of the assignment grade, and we'll retest everything that was required for the checkpoint. So if you got something wrong in the checkpoint and you fix it for the final submission, you'll still get most of the credit for it. Yeah?
Will we know our score on the checkpoint before we turn in the final?
Will you know your score on the checkpoint before you turn in the final? I don't think I can guarantee that because I'm not sure how many special cases I'm going to have grading things. Like, hopefully I'll be able to just turn around grades like the Monday after the checkpoints do, but I'm not sure that will happen. We do supply pretty good tests with the shell assignment, so you are not likely to be surprised by your score. Also, for the checkpoint, we might deliberately not test tricky cases for the checkpoint.
So we'll get test results back for the final.
So the shell assignment comes with some skeleton code, which includes a testing program. The testing program does not include all the tests we will run on your submissions, but it includes tests. So you'll have some tests, and you can add tests to that, of course, if you want to test, if you want to just use that as your testing tool. The main reason we supply it is to make sure our auto grader doesn't break because of something stupid like you having a different prompt than you're supposed to have. Because that would just be not really useful for anyone. Okay. Other logistics questions? Okay. So I mentioned searching for programs. So the convention on POSIX is that they use the environment variable. This is actually really easy to implement. So one thing you can do is extend, when you exec a program, you can just try execing every possible thing with all the directories you're searching on. And because when exec fails, it returns. And when it doesn't fail, it keeps going. You just do this until you run out of paths. And if you exit the loop, you didn't find it. So that's one simple way of implementing that, but it's not part of the assignment. Yeah.
What if you had two programs with the same name and different directories? How would you know that you ended up on the right one?
So the question is, what if we had two programs with the same name and different directories? So the rule for typical shells on Unix is that when you have this path environment variable, the first thing on the path is the one that gets run. But something I am missing here is we should have some error checking code here that says if the error was not that wasn't found, then we give you an error message. So for example, if you try to run the program and it's there but it's broken, it prints out an error in XSet. So we're missing that to make sure that doesn't happen. Okay. Other questions? So for running in the background, so something that typical shells do for this is that they just start the program. They usually print out the PID that's running. We don't actually require that for our assignment. And then later on, they check whether it finished and print out a message about it being finished. We require a message not in this format for our assignment. So basically, what we'll have you do for your shell is what typically shells do is that before they print a prompt, they're going to say, oh, all these backward processes, are they done yet? And if they're done, they're going to print out their exit status, and that's what we're going to have you print out. We're not going to have you print it out in this format. We're going to have you print out something like long computation exit status and the number that was returned from it. And we don't care if you print out the PID, though wouldn't be hard to, but that's not something we want you to do, in fact. And you might say, this doesn't tell you immediately when the program finished, and that's kind of a deliberate choice these shells make because it would sure be inconvenient if you type ls and in the middle of your ls output is, hey, your program finished. So they just avoid doing that. So redirection. So redirection, you could run a program but use it as input, use some file as input with the less than operator, and it's just like you copied and pasted the file into the terminal, basically. And you can use a file as output, like you took the output and copied and pasted it into that file, basically. And the way that redirection works internally is not that the shell was reading the terminal, then cutting the output out. It doesn't do that. We're taking advantage of the fact that when we exec, we aren't changing these open files. So typically, the reason the program outputs to the terminal in the first place is that these open files here point to the terminal. And what the shell is going to do when you have redirection, it's going to make them point to something else. In the case where we're redirecting to a file, they're going to not point to the terminal, but to some regular file on disk. And that means when the program tries to write to its open file, that would normally be the terminal, and ends up writing to a file on disk. Or when it tries to read from a file, that would normally be the terminal, and ends up reading from a file on disk. So the typical pattern we'll see is that in the child will open some new files, make them replace the terminal before re-exec. And this is one of the reasons why you might think that the POSIX people chose not to have like a fork and exec system call, because this allows us to support changing what the files are without adding extra arguments to all our system calls. We just need to have the ways of manipulating the files that you could do without forking. It's useful without forking even, like opening new files. It's a useful thing to do without forking. Now we just do it before we exec in the new process rather than having it affect both. So questions on this general procedure? Okay. So this means that standard out error input, that's standard out, standard error, standard in C, C out, CR, CN, C++, are files. They're always files. So after forking, we open files to redirect, and we somehow make them be assigned to standard in, standard out, and standard error. And I'll talk about how that works later. But there's some extra step there, because obviously if you just open a file on disk, printf doesn't magically just go there. And you're probably happy for that, because that would be really inconvenient. Okay, so let's talk about pipelines. So pipelines just mean that we use the same trick of having the file be open, but instead of it open to a file on disk or a terminal, it's going to be open to something which when you write to it, you'll be able to read from it from another file, another open file. But it's the same mechanism as far as replacing standard in and standard out that we're going to use for redirection. But instead of redirecting to a file, we're going to redirect to this special kind of file called a pipe that we'll talk about later. Right. Okay. So another note about the shell assignment is that the parsing in the shell assignment is simplified. So one thing that this class is not about is string parsing. So it's all space separated, even though the examples I give are not. So your shell, you can just separate things into by space. You can just look for words separated by white space, and that's your commands. You don't need to look for a pipe character in the middle of without spaces around it. It's always going to have spaces around it, just to make things simpler. Because I don't want you writing, you know, a 50-line parser for this assignment. That's not what this class is about. So any questions on shells and the shell assignment? I'm sure there will be more questions in the shell assignment after people start looking at it. But. Okay, so let's talk a bit about files, which is going to get to talking about how redirection works eventually. So in POSIX, I mentioned files are how we access everything, how we access devices like terminals or printers, how we access what we usually think of as files, that's regular files on disk. And regular file is the actual POSIX term for that, is a file on disk. How we access networks, how we communicate with servers, is a special type of file called sockets that we'll talk about later. And how we do many types of inter-process communication. If I have two programs that I want to communicate with, I can set up special types of files to talk between two processes. One of those is called a pipe, which is what's used to implement that pipeline that some program filtered by some other program. There's a special kind of file which you can write to it from one process and read to it from another. And no matter what type of thing it refers to, all these files have the same basic operations, some sort of open operation, which is typically open, but we'll have some exceptions. Read and write which are the actual names of the library calls and on XV6, the system calls that correspond to them, and close. And this is the common interface. So our interface has these common attributes for all these files, that we always open something, we get a file opened before we are allowed to use it. We can't just say, read from this file on disk by this name, we have to open the file, then read from it. And this open process is where any setup happens and also where access control happens. So that's where the OS decides, oh, you aren't actually allowed to access this file, it belongs to another user, it happens at open. They're all byte-oriented, so our read and write calls are going to take a number of bytes, are going to take a buffer, which is going to interpret as an array of bytes, even if the device doesn't really work that way. So disks don't actually work on a byte-by-byte basis. They have these larger chunks called sectors that they can read in and write in, and they can't do anything smaller. The operating system needs to hide that. Is to make it look like you can read and write single bytes. And we have this explicit close that when you're done with a file, you're going to explicitly say, I'm done with it, or implicitly say, I'm done by having your whole process go away, in which case the OS will know, yeah, you went to close all your files. But otherwise, the OS assumes that if you don't close it, you still want it around, it needs to let you still access it. So any questions about these attributes? Okay. So let's talk more about this second thing, that when we have these real devices, they aren't really byte-oriented. They don't really work in this read-write fashion, and the OS needs to hide that. And this means that in a typical POSIX implementation, the kernel is going to be doing buffering. So if we think about key presses, I press a key, and the kernel needs to handle that right away, or else if I press another key after that, maybe I'll lose the first key press. The keyboard's not going to keep all the key presses all around, it's just going to keep a very small set of them. So the OS needs to copy that to its own buffer. And then sometime later on, the program might read, and the OS needs to return that key press that it buffered earlier. So even though we think of read as reading from the keyboard, what it's really doing is reading from this buffer that the kernel keeps. Now, it could be the case that we call read before I press a key, in which case it's going to be the other way around. But in typical implementations, the actual flow is of the data is the same. That I call read, that puts my program to sleep until there's data ready, but the OS still reads the data first into this buffer. This is always what it does, and later on it runs the program and then copies that data back to the program. And this happens with other devices. So if I read one character from a file, well, I'm not going to have, probably not going to have the disks opportunistically sending me the exact file I want, unless I do something. So I read one character from a file, and I need to get a copy of that data. So we'll read a block of data from disk. The disk is not going to support reading one byte. So the OS is not going to do that. It's going to read an entire block of data from the disk. It's going to put that block in some buffer in its memory. And then to satisfy the read call, it's going to copy from that buffer into the program's memory. Yes?
So for example, the key press, does the second step read character from terminal, is that for the actual, let's say we press A, the letter A sort of
register? So the question is, what's this read character from terminal step mean? So what I mean by this is that this is the read call. And this is the read call here. So this is the actual system call. This is the actual code in the program that's trying to get a character from the terminal or the file. And that code, we learned, is going to make a system call because that's the only way it has of accessing these devices, because as a user program, it's not allowed to do it. Only the kernel can do that. It has to happen in kernel mode. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Can we think of buffers as like arrays within memory, or?
So the question is the buffer like an array? Generally, yes. Okay, other questions? So this is on read, and the same thing is going to happen on write. When we print a care, let's say we want to send something to a remote machine, like over an SSH connection, this is going to be done in the program with a write call. That's conceptually how the print operation, printf or whatever, is going to be implemented. And the operating system probably isn't going to implement that by actually just sending to the network before the write call returns. It's going to have a buffer of output waiting to go to the network, and then when the network device says it's ready, it's going to actually send it. That's the typical implementation. And the same thing is going to be true for, say, writing to disk. We're going to make our write call, which might happen because of a printf call, to write a character, say, to a file on disk. The OS is going to have a buffer of data waiting to go on disk, and it's going to write an entire block, because that's what the disk supports, at a time. So in both cases, even though you think of these system calls as sort of directly just accessing the device, we have this indirection where we're actually going to keep data around, and this is mainly because the interface doesn't quite match up. We expect read from the keyboard to read things that have already been entered. We expect writing to the network to write something a byte at a time, even if the network doesn't work that way, and the same with the disk. And to bridge that gap, typically all our reads and writes, even though they're system calls, are going to still have buffering in the kernel to actually communicate with the device on the device's terms, when the device is ready for our output, and with the amount of data we need to transfer at a time in either direction. So you can think of read and write's main job is moving data into and out of buffers, and blocking if the buffer is full or empty, and we need to wait for the device to either give us more data or be ready to use to get rid of more data. This is the default behavior. Yes, it is possible to do something where the write call will directly cause the disk to write before it returns, but that's not the default on Unix-like systems. And typically, we're just going to send things into and out of the buffers, and the actual I/O will happen whenever the device is ready. So any questions on timing here? And later on in the semester, we'll talk more about how device drivers work, which will hopefully make this even clearer. So a notable consequence of this is that there's a lot of buffering. So typically, when we're using our application, we don't call read and write, these system calls. We call things like cout and printf. And cout and printf have their own buffers. And those are separate from the kernel's buffers. So typically when you're outputting to a file or the terminal, you're outputting with cout or ofstream or fprintf. And that's going to first start using a buffer in the standard library in the user program. And that code is going to eventually call write using these system calls to access the kernel. The kernel's going to buffer it itself until the device is ready. So there's actually two sets of buffers going on most of the time. Yeah?
Are the other buffers files or like in memory?
So the question is, what are these buffers here?
Yeah.
They are just memory. So typically, like the standard library will malloc some array or something like that. Other questions? So you might say, well, if we already have buffering in the kernel, why do cout and printf bother having their own buffers? And they don't need to, right? They could just output directly. And if you look at a very simple implementation, like XV6's printf, it in fact just outputs directly. It calls write, it doesn't have a buffer. But the reason to have a buffer is that that's slow. That XV6's printf, it turns out, calls write for every character. Rather than keeping a buffer, if you can avoid calling write for every character, that's going to be faster. And that's why they're doing it. They don't want to make system calls as often. System calls, they're not really slow, but they're not fast. They're not like, they're much slower than a function call. Because we have to like save all the registers on the kernel stack for every single one. Like, that's not something you actually want to do for every character of output, especially to a file. Now that's why they're doing it. Okay. So these are our layers. So let's start by talking about open. And the first thing which comes up when we open files is we need to name them. And we're used to these regular files being these named collections of bytes. So they have a name. We have this hierarchy of names. So they're organized in directories. And this is what our most common open function is going to take advantage of, that we have some name for a collection of bytes that we can read or write to. And we need to be able to access it. And in POSIX, the way to access a file, we have to open it, we can supply one of these names along with information about what we want to do with it. And that's with this open call. So there are two prototypes for open. You may ask, wait, how can you have two prototypes in C? They just do. Even though that probably was a bad decision. So they take a path, which is the name in the hierarchy, and flags, which are, do I want to read or write this file, and things like that. And it returns an int, which is known as a file descriptor. So after we open a file, all of our open files are referred to with a number, which is called the file descriptor. And that's going to be numbers that only make sense in our process. So file descriptor 17 in one process will not be the same as another. And that's what we're going to supply to read, write, and everything else which refers to an open file. We're going to supply this file descriptor that open returns. If open fails, instead of returning a file descriptor that's a non-negative number, it's going to return negative one. And that's how we know if it fails. So the first argument is this path. So we can have something, an absolute path that starts with a slash, or one which is relevant to the current working directory, which we set with a system call known as chdir, library call known as chdir. And open will do the work of finding the file in the directory. When we talk about file systems, we'll talk a lot more about how that process works. I mentioned it returns a file descriptor. And the way we're going to think of these file descriptors as an index into a table for each process. So each process has this table. On XV6, it's literally an array in the process control block of what are called open file descriptions. And we're just going to pass the index in this table for every system call that needs to manipulate an open file. So for read, we're going to say, I want to read using this index into the open file table for my process. As I said, on XV6, literally an array. So this is how it's represented. It's an array of these struct file stars. Each one of those file stars is an open file. And it's just a fixed sized array. If you need more than NO files, open files, sorry, you can't get that. And the idea is that when you supply zero, file descriptor 0, that's O file index 0 for your process. This is per process because it's part of the struct proc. And this is a pointer. And it turns out that on XV6 and on a typical Unix-like OS, these can be shared between processes. So two processes can have pointers to the same open file. And when you fork a process, we copy the pointers, we do not do a deep copy. Also, we sometimes don't have a file open. If we don't, the way XV6 represents this is just leaves the entry null. So then we have this struct file. So here's what's in the struct file in XP6. Obviously, there might be different information other OSs would use. So XP6 keeps track of the type of the file. So there's two types of files that XP6 supports. They're pipes, which are used to communicate between two programs, and other types of files, which it calls inodes. We'll talk about why it calls them inodes much later. This is just one possible design. You could imagine doing this with like classes and objects, or pointers to lists of functions is what Linux does. But we have some way of representing, we have lots of types of files, we need to handle all of them with this one struct. We have a reference count. So you might say, if we copy the pointers when we fork a new process, how do we make sure we don't leak memory or we don't have use after free problems? XV6 prevents this by keeping track of how many pointers there are to this file. And only when that count goes to zero does it free them. So this way, it doesn't matter if you forget to close things correctly, it still knows how many there are and doesn't leak memory in the OS, which would be really bad. Now we keep track of whether reads or writes are allowed. So when you open the file, you decide, do I want to read, do I want to write? We remember that decision here. And the assumption is that if we have the file open, you're allowed to read or write it. That we've already checked whether you're supposed to access it, we're not going to check again. We also have the offset. So a notable thing about the pointers being shared is that if you have two copies of the same file, you fork, you have the same file in both processes. If one writes and the other writes, each of those writes advances this offset in a regular file, because it's the same open file. So this is what we track, how we track where we are in a file on disk. For something like the terminal or a pipe, this is not so meaningful. But we just have it in the struct because it's just an array. We don't bother trying to save that little bit of memory to not store it for when we don't need it. And we also have pointers to data for each particular type of file in case we need it, in case we want to actually figure out how to do a read or a write. Okay, so any questions on what's in our open files? Okay, so I mentioned that we have this array of files, each of which has an index, and that's how we access things. You might have noticed that at no point did I say, well, this is our normal terminal input, or this is not. And the way that works is that there's just a convention. That there's nothing in the system calls which makes it this way, but our convention on POSIX is that we'll use index 0 for our input, index 1 for our normal output, index 2 for a normal error output. And this is what standard in, standard out, standard error, or what C in, C out, C error correspond to. And this is just, we just made this arbitrary choice that we would assign the numbers that way. And POSIX even defines constants for this, but there's nothing the kernel is doing with exec or fork that actually does anything about this. It's just copying the table as is. The assumption is you're going to set this up when you run programs because that's what they're going to expect. You don't have to actually do this. You could like close all these file descriptors and never use them. Okay. Now, you might say, okay, this is great. Now I know how to read and write to my input and output that I expect, but how do I implement redirection? I can't choose the number open assigns. We'll get to that later. Indeed, you cannot. Okay. So open also has flags. And we saw that we kept track of whether an open file was readable or writable. This is where you ask for that. This is also where you ask for things like, oh, I'd like to open a file on disk and create it if you need it, if it doesn't already exist. Or I'd like to open a file on disk and please truncate it, make it zero length if it already has stuff in it. I want to overwrite it. And you request things like that. You can read the man page with man to open on Linux to find all the possible flags. The real important ones are all on this slide. And basically, read write and whether you want to truncate or create a new file. So there's this third argument, which is the mode argument. These are the permissions of the newly created file. If you have to do this, I would just always pass 0666, which specifies readable or writable by anyone, except as controlled by something called the UMASP. We may talk about that a lot later in the semester when we actually talk about access control. Okay, so we have opening files. Any questions about opening files and the array of open files? Okay, so we open files. We also want to be able to close files. So there's a system call, a library call for that, close. It takes a file descriptor and it deallocates that array index. So you might think of this as like actually freeing the open file. That's not what it does. It just clears the array index. And if that's the last reference to that file, then it's freed. But if it's not, it's not. So you can think of it as setting that index to null and garbage collecting it if need be. Yes?
When you close a file descriptor and then that index is available, that number, does the program then fill the next open file into that now empty index, or does it fill
up? So the question is, if I free up an index, does that shift the other files?
Yeah.
And the answer is no. The file descriptor that's returned from open is never going to change unless you explicitly do something to cause that to happen. Okay. So this deallocating the array index means that if you fork, the child still has a copy of that file. If you close it in the parent, it doesn't close it in the child, even though it's the same open file. And open has a return value to indicate whether it's successful or not. You might say, wait, or close rather. You might say, close can fail. Yes, it can. So for example, it might run out of disk space while trying to save the file. And if you don't check the return value, you'll never know. Maybe not the best API choice, but that's how it works. Okay, so we've talked about open and close. Now let's figure out fixing our redirection problem. That I want to do this operation, and I know my two steps. First, I'm going to need to open output.txt. We've seen how to do that. We can call open. We can get a file descriptor for output.txt that's open for writing. But now we want that file descriptor not to be some random new file descriptor, but to be assigned number one, because we learned that's where we expect output to go. So how can we do this second step? And if we think about what we're trying to do, we have this table of open files. What we really want to do is just assign an entry in that table to another entry. Now, we can't actually do that ourselves because this is in the kernel's memory. If we try to do that, it's not our memory. We'll get the equivalent of a segfault. But there's a system call to let us do that, which is going to be dupe2. So dupe2 is going to do exactly this operation. It's going to take a file descriptor to copy from to put here, and a file descriptor to copy to put here. And it will just do that assignment and update the reference count. So this lets us reassign a file descriptor to a different number. And this is how we make output go to somewhere else. So our tool is this dupe2, old to new, to make new file descriptor. We started the same as the old. And the way this works is that if newFD is already opened, it's going to close it for you as part of the operation. It's going to close it and reassign it. So we don't need to worry that standard out's already open. We can just dupe2 onto standard out, and it will take care of closing the old standard out for us. Yes?
Is there a system call to switch them?
So there's a system call to swap instead. Not one in POSIX. So the typical pattern for that reason is going to look something like this. That first, because I'm in a neural program, first I'm going to clear printf's buffer to make sure that we don't get old output going to our new file. I'm going to open my output.txt, handle errors. I'm going to make that new file descriptor be standard out. So now if I write to either of them, I'll end up writing to the same thing. And we're going to close the original version, set that entry to null, the copy of the pointer still works, and then when I printf now, it's going to go to the new file. Does this make sense? So this is how we implement redirection. I'm only showing output redirection. Input redirection is the same, except we do two on the standard in and open for reading. And this is what, when you're doing that in the shell, you'll do before you exec. So when you exec, their file descriptor 0, 1, and 2 point to the correct files. So any questions here? Okay, so you might say, dupe 2, what's the 2 for? Is there a dupe 1? Well, there's a dupe, which is like dupe 2, except it chooses a new file descriptor number for you. It's not particularly useful for the assignment, but that's why there's what dupe is and how it's related to dupe 2. So it's dupe is dupe 2 onto a new file descriptor number that is unused. But it's not actually useful for what we'll be doing, for the most part. Okay, so I've talked about opening and closing and reassigning file descriptors. Now let's actually talk about using them to like do input and output, like what they're for. And we saw that we can do this indirectly via the tools we know about, like printf. We can also do directly how printf is going to be implemented with the read and write functions. So these are the prototypes of read and write. So they each take a buffer, which is a void star type, but it's just going to be interpreted as a bunch of bytes. We specify how many bytes with this count and the file descriptor to use. They return this SIC type, which is assigned size T is what it stands for. It's a just assigned integer type. So they return the number of bytes actually read or written, which might be not the number you ask for. For example, if I ask to read a million characters from the terminal, probably not going to get a million. So I'll get a smaller number. Or they return -1 if there's an error. And if there's an error, they'll put the error code in ErrorNo, which I briefly mentioned some other time. PError is a way to print out what happened. For returning the number of bytes written, they can return 0. 0 is not an error. 0 means you reached the end of a file. So if you have an empty file and you read from it, you'll get 0, not -1, because yeah, you successfully read nothing. Good work. And if you read from it and you're at the and you've read everything, you'll get 0 because yeah, there's nothing more to read, but we successfully did that, so it's not an error. All of these can read or write less than requested, especially due to things that aren't end of file. So for example, if I'm reading from a device and it breaks, I'm going to still get the data that's read, and then I'll have to call read again to find out that it's broken. And if I'm writing to a device that breaks, well, the OS is going to tell me how much it wrote before it broke, then it's going to tell me it's broken. It's not going to just say, you figure out how much actually got written successfully. It's going to tell you by returning from your first write call with, I wrote this much, and then maybe something bad will happen. So this is an example of how you can use read. So here I'm reading one byte at a time. I'm checking the return value to see if I'm done reading from whatever I'm reading. So if standard in points to a regular file, I'll get 0 eventually. On the terminal, on Linux, if you type control D, that produces end of file, and you get zero from that. And then I check for whether if an error happened, or I had end of file. So this code makes sense. Yeah?
This is a little bit of a separate question, but why would you use Duke 2 rather than just passing the file descriptor that you, like the original file descriptor into reader, right?
So the question is, why would I use Duke 2? So the main answer is because I want to run a program like this, where I don't have a way of telling the program, hey, use output.txt instead of your normal output. That's the main reason I would do it. So this example here is contrived.
Okay, so it would usually just like use standard out, so you have to switch it so that it...
So that it works the way you want. And you might do this for code within the same process. If like I'm using a library and it outputs everything as standard error and I can't change that, I can change where standard error goes to make that, to manage that, rather than editing the library code to fix it. Okay, so I mentioned that it does up to that number. So this means that if you want to read an amount, this is sort of the code we have. So I have a buffer of a constant size. I'm casting to void star because this is C++ code, and in C++ you need to do that, in C you never do. So I'm reading from standard in, I'm keeping track of where I am in my buffer, and I'm reading until I either get a zero from an error from read, or I finish reading. I guess this probably should be, I probably should check for end of file. You might say, wait, you're asking to read initially some amount, and why would you not get everything read other than end of file? What could possibly happen? Well, on regular files, read's going to give you what request, or indicate end of file. So it's going to give you what you request if it's there, or end of file. But things aren't so great on other types of files. So if we think about, for example, reading from the network, if I ask to read 1,000 bytes and I've received 500 bytes, the decision that POSIX systems typically make is I'm going to give you the 500 bytes I have now, and you'll have to figure out whether you need to call read again to get the rest. Because I don't know whether there's more bytes coming or not. So I'm just going to give you what I have now. You need to figure out if that's everything you want, or if you want to keep calling read until you get everything. And for a keyboard, for example, if I ask to read 1,000 bytes from the keyboard, it's going to typically return when I have my first input rather than wait for me to type 1,000 characters. And this allows me to not read character by character if I want to wait just for some inputs. So that makes sense, this notion of partial reads. So read, yeah, gives you what's available, but it's not an error if there's less available, and it's not going to wait for that number of bytes to be available on things which aren't regular files. Yeah?
So like for the reading from keyboard example, would that be in like the case where you already have something in the buffer, and it just automatically reads in all of that, even if it's less?
Yes. So yeah, if you already have, so for reading from your keyboard, if you already have stuff in the buffer, it will just give you that rather than waiting.
Okay.
With the caveat that often the terminal is configured so it will wait for a new line before returning. But yeah, it will give you what's there rather than waiting for it to fill up. And that's usually what you want when you're reading from the keyboard anyways. So for write, this is a simple write. As I said, you write bytes, you need to specify the size. So this is what a write might look like. Now, write, just like a read, can write less than requested, and it can also fail. So we want to have both checking if we write less than the 14 bytes I wanted. This is quickly getting really annoying. I'm just writing a string, and now I need to write a loop. That's why you use printf. And we check if it fails, and we check if we didn't write as much as we requested and keep try again. Now, you might say, why would we have a not write everything we wanted? And typically, this only happens if there's an error. So the only common case where that happens is like if I'm writing to a network connection, my first write might succeed, then the network connection breaks. I'll get a write of less than I requested, and then when I call write again, it's gonna tell me, oh, the network connection's broken, sorry. But if you don't check what write returns, you'll never find that out, and that would be very bad. You know, you try to transfer a file, you didn't transfer the whole file, and you never know. So you do want to check it, but the typical cases are just on cases where there's gonna be an error and you just want to make sure you know about it. But the error is not gonna result in write failing because it's not gonna lie to you about how much actually was written and just say there was an error sometime. But typically write will wait until it completes as long as nothing's wrong. Questions on partial writes? That's our write. Okay, and as I mentioned, standard out, cout, printf, and so on do buffering. So they're implemented in terms of read, write, open, and close, but they do their own buffering, mostly to avoid making system calls all the time, because that's slow. Now, a note about that using them along with read and write. Don't mix them. Or don't do it unless you're careful. So the issue is you call cn, you read something in, cn and scanf probably read like a kilobyte if they can, read as much as they can from the keyboard, and if there's extra keyboard input, they're gonna use it the next time you call cn, but if you call read, you're not gonna see that. It was already read by cn. And for example, if you printf, you know, if you call printf, then you call write, then you call printf, those printfs might not appear in the right order because maybe the first printf just put it in a buffer and it wasn't printed out to the second one. So you need to manage that if you want to mix the two. There are some standard IO calls to say, hey, get rid of the buffer for both reading and writing, but you have to actually use them in order to mix them. The general advice is just don't do it. Like, typically for any file, only use read and write on it or only use standard IO stuff on it. Just don't mix. Okay. Questions? Okay, so I've talked about read and write, and we have one feature of our shell that I said I'd get to, which was connecting two processes. And we're gonna have a special kind of file for that called pipes. And the way pipes work are that you have two ends. Each of the ends is gonna be represented by a file descriptor. You put bytes in one end with write, and they come out the other end with read. And there's a POSIX library call called pipe, which creates a pipe. It gives you, you give it an array of file descriptors, it fills in two file descriptors in that array, and you can use that to communicate between processes. And this is how this shell pipelines send one process's output to another is typically implemented with these special files. So the way this works is we have our array of two file descriptors, we call pipe, we check for an error like out of memory. And assuming there's no error, we have our read end and our write end, and we write to the write end and read from the read end. So people look confused. And the idea is what we write to this write end ends up being read from the read end. I guess one thing that I kind of gloss over here is I'm saying we're doing this from two processes. You might say, how do the two processes both get these file descriptors? The typical way is that the two processes are related by fork. So we do this, then we fork, and now they both have copies of both the write and read FDs. Yes?
I think your mic turned off.
Oh, okay. It doesn't believe it's turned off. Oh, yeah, okay. guess it thinks it's out of battery, and I can't fix that now, so I will be trying to speak louder. Okay, so that's how we have the two processes related by fork. Now, some notes about using this. So you'll see if we're making this with the pipeline, we're going to call pipe, and then we're going to call dupe2 to make one of these ends standard out. So when the program writes to its standard out, it goes to the other process, and the other end is going to be set to standard in. So when that program reads from its input, it reads from the other process's writes. Yes?
Can you redirection on either side of the pipe?
So the question is, do shells support something like this? And the answer is yes, and it is also required that you implement that in your assignment. Yes?
So since both, if you use fork, then both processes would have the same open files, so technically could you, like, both files are able to read and write from the pipe file, right?
So the question is, after fork, both processes could either read or write and mix that up? Yes. I don't recommend that. I recommend having two pipes if that's what you want to do, but that is supported. Okay, so a note about pipes. So here's some code which doesn't use multiple processes. And this code is likely to hang, not terminate. So what's the problem? The question is, do I need to close the right end of the pipe before I read? And the answer is no. It's not what the problem is here. There sometimes are issues with doing that, but that's mostly when you're looking for end of file. But we tell if there's end of file by looking at the return value of read, which we aren't even checking. The question is, do I need to read from the right end and write from the read end? No, the ends are correct. So as a hint as to things that aren't wrong, if I replace this big size with something smaller, it probably doesn't hang. So it's something about how much stuff I'm putting through the pipe. If I have the big size replaced with something small, probably it not only doesn't hang, but the reads and writes are both successful. So it's something about the size. Okay, so let's think about how write is implemented. So we mentioned buffering in the kernel, and this is in fact how pipes are implemented. So when I call write from a program, in our kernel, there is a buffer that this copies into. And when I call read, it reads from this buffer. And a good question is, how big is that buffer? And the answer is some fixed size. So if you ask to write too much, write's going to wait because there's not enough space in the buffer yet, and it's going to wait until there is. And the way we free up space in the buffer is by calling read, but we're never going to do that because we're waiting for write to finish. And because write typically waits until it tries to transfer everything rather than just doing what's available by default, and that applies here, that write is just going to wait forever for a read that's never going to happen. Yeah?
So this wouldn't be a case where you get a partial write. It would block.
Yeah, so this wouldn't be a case where you get a partial write. It would block. You could request to get a partial write instead, but you need some extra code to do that. Yes?
So why exactly doesn't this happen in two processes?
So in two processes, we'll have one process is going to be running write, and at the same time, the other one's going to be running read. So we'll have the reading process, we'll be freeing up space in the buffer so the write eventually completes. Yeah? The question is, as a general thing, if the write size is bigger than the buffer size, will it always hang? By default, yes. You need to do something to make it not. Or an error needs to happen. Yeah.
So the pipe is entirely in that buffer. There's no actual file for...
The question is, there's no actual file. In this model, yes, you could imagine the kernel has the option of doing other things. But the most common implementation is that there's a fixed size buffer, and that's it. Okay, so we'll pick up here next time. A little more about pipes, some other details of the POSIX API.